Hard to Believe is proud to be a part of the Cage Club Podcast Network. For more episodes and to discover other great shows, check out cageclub.me. In the book Theology and the Films of Terrence Malick, a 2016 collection of essays edited by Christopher Barnett and Clark Elliston, professors of religious studies at Villanova and Shriner University, respectively, Elliston introduces his essay on Malick's 2005 film, The New World, with the following, quote, Terrence Malick divides viewers like few other filmmakers can. Frequent voiceovers, muted dialogue, extended takes of nature, and abstract themes all contribute to the divisiveness of his films. The viewer who dislikes these aspects of Malick's work will detest The New World. It possesses neither the relatively fast pace of The Thin Red Line, nor the explicit metaphysical motivation of The Tree of Life. For those interested in historical depictions, Malick remains typically muted on his emphasis. He does not right the wrongs within history. How, then, does one approach a Malickian historical film like The New World, where the subject seems to be neither metaphysics nor history? Initially, the response might be romance. After all, the Pocahontas John Smith narrative has entertained readers for generations. However, Malick has as little interest in this interpretation as he does in one of historical accuracy. A provisional answer lies in the figure of Pocahontas herself, as she guides the film from beginning to end. Her voiceover animates the narrative, and her death concludes it. So how does the viewer encounter the figure of Pocahontas? Is she, in Malick's hands, the ingenue in a revisionist tale of love? Or is she a symbol presaging the acquisitive and the destructive inclinations of the colonial West? Although few would deny Pocahontas' centrality to Malick's narrative in The New World, interpreting her within that narrative proves more challenging. Malick undermines classical narratives depicting her life with John Smith as the consummate romance. In fact, the film dwells very little on their relationship as such. Yet neither does it entirely subvert the wonder of the Western world. Pocahontas' visit to England evokes the same wonder in her as Virginia does in the English colonists. Hers is therefore not the story of an idealized natural society spoiled by its encounter with the insidious West. Pocahontas attends to the world around her, and the people in that world. Her search for the divine other in those relationships opens her not to a new geographical world, but a spiritual one. Moreover, her seeking does not remove her from this world, but frames her existence within the world. This existence invites both love and suffering. Despite her suffering, she is not destroyed. By the end of the film, her relationship with the transcendent other has reconciled the rift born within her as the mediator between worlds. As such, she becomes a Christological figure. She bears the weight of colliding worlds rather than a cross. Pocahontas' embrace of her existence in between worlds culminates in reconciliation with the ground of all worlds, the divine other. Her redemption manifests itself in the renewed sense of spiritual vision, such that Malick has her say upon her death, "Now, mother, I know where you live." End quote. In his fictionalized and highly personal take on the early days of the Jamestown colony, Terrence Malick explores the most confounding elements of the human condition, one that's central to the myth of Adam and Eve, Pandora, Voltaire's 18th century satire Candide, our sense that the world we have inherited is not the world as it has to be. That there's more, and that we can and that we must chase Eden, a better world, a new world, regardless of how destructive and fruitless that chase may be. My guest today is Matthew Williams. Matt teaches American history at the Dalton School in New York City. He earned a PhD in American history at SUNY Binghamton, where his focus was on early America, and that makes him the perfect person to talk to today about Terrence Malick's The New World. I'm John Brooks, and this is Hard to Believe. A PhD, Matt, in anything is hard. So two questions. First of all, how are you doing? And second of all, why do you have a PhD in American history?
You know, just like everyone here and elsewhere, you know, I live in Manhattan with my wife. We're just hanging in there. I think I'm getting accustomed to the stay-at-home sort of thing. Get out maybe once or twice a week. But yeah, I mean, obviously definitely looking forward to the end of this, but we have to wait on that. And yeah, it's a bit of a roundabout way towards getting my PhD. I worked in book publishing for 10 years, happily and then not so happily. And during that time, developed an interest on my own, just reading American history. And my wife, who was my girlfriend at the time, prompted me into maybe pursuing that at graduate school. And you know, I was fortunate enough to get a fellowship and acceptance to Binghamton University slash SUNY Binghamton. And yeah, 6.5 years later, at the ripe old age of 42 or 43, I had my PhD, and now I'm a I teach at the Dalton School, and did a lot of work in this kind of field in Virginia because my advisor was a Virginian. So yeah, it was an unexpected career path, but I really enjoy and love what I'm doing now.
So especially Virginia-based early American history is something that you know quite a bit about.
Yeah, I feel pretty good about it. My specialty was I wrote my dissertation on New York City in the 18th century, but when your advisor does anything, you by definition do it too. A lot of reading on tobacco culture in the 16th century. I mean, I remember a lot about that actually. And he assigned books to his undergraduates that I read, being his one of his teaching assistants. So yeah, it all kind of sunk in there, which may have a little to do with why I love this movie so much.
Yeah, I do remember my 8th grade history teacher who has was really into. I grew up in a place that was heavily connected to the King Philip War. So like our local park was called Metacomet Park, and so there, so I had a my English my history teacher in 8th grade was a local historian, and I remember him saying something along the lines of, if not for tobacco, everybody would have packed up and gone home and we wouldn't have an America.
Yeah, I mean, the Spanish probably would have just proceeded up from Florida at the time, and it would be a far different sort of state of affairs. But thankfully, the Brits and the Europeans got addicted to sugar, and they got addicted to tobacco, and all it took was the most awful, vile regime of human bondage the world's ever known. Funny how that works.
So let's talk a little bit about the New World, which we're going to talk about more. We're going to do a little bit about Terrence Malick himself and his films. Tell me about your relationship to this movie. We're talking on Facebook, which is when we both discovered that we're really big fans of this movie.
Well, I definitely saw it when it first came out in theaters, and before that had seen The Thin Red Line, and when that came out in 1998, and I remember all the hype in the entertainment industry about Malick coming back to the screen, and didn't know much about him before 1998, and then when The New World came out, I definitely had to go see it, and it just kind of just struck this immense chord with me, not just because of the subject matter, but the whole idea of the way a film could be done that way, in which the natural world takes on a character of its own, and there's a certain poetry to the proceedings, the romantic story, I would say, with an actual realism about life during the 1607 to 1609 or so period of time, was just kind of, I didn't really know you could tell a story that way by evoking feelings within characters and then within the viewer to that sort of profound degree, without relying on tons of dialogue necessarily or dramatic plot shifts. So it was kind of a revelation to me, not really being, I would say, a film scholar by any means. So it just kind of, I think if you're a reflective, thoughtful lover of film of whatever stripe that might be, you can find something in this movie to satisfy you.
Let's dig a little bit into Malick himself, who he is. I don't think he's the most famous film director out there. I'm sure some people who are above average film buffs know who Terrence Malick is and are familiar with some, if not all, of his work. But he has a very kind of unique story as a filmmaker. A lot of filmmakers get a lot of pushback and flack for being kind of overly
philosophical or sort of musing on theology. But Malick actually has the background to kind of back it up. So Malick was born Thomas Frederick Malick, which is just too much of a mouthful. We'll call him Terry.
Yeah.
I think his friends call him Terry.
I think we can do that, I think. Yeah, we're good.
He was born in Ottawa, Illinois in 1943. I didn't know there was an Ottawa, Illinois.
I had no idea.
Raised in Oklahoma and Texas, which explains why there tends to be a lot of Oklahoma and Texas in some of his movies. He attended Harvard University, graduating with a degree in philosophy in 1965. So at the age of 22, Terrence Malick is a guy who went from Illinois to Texas to Cambridge, Massachusetts, and walked out of Harvard University with a philosophy degree. So certainly not so far a person that you would think, oh yeah, he's going to direct a bunch of critically acclaimed Academy Award winning slash nominated movies. But he's the real deal. So he actually has the background in philosophy to back up his philosophical musings. After Harvard, he went to study at Oxford as a Rhodes Scholar, but he dropped out to work as a freelance journalist and then went on to serve as a philosophy professor at MIT. So back to Cambridge, back to all the smart kids, and back to the philosophy. So, you know, in his mid-20s, Malick has just been a philosophy professor. That seems to be his game, right? Like, I think by then, you talked about having been in book publishing for a while and then dropping out and going back to school and then being a high school teacher. But I feel like if I was teaching at MIT by my mid-20s, like, yeah, that's my career.
And for a lot of people, it would have been. I mean, that would have been, you know, a dream career path, you know, especially yeah, then and now.
I was in transition, just teaching philosophy at MIT.
Yeah, I just found myself. Yeah. You know.
So this tells us quite a bit about Malick and his ambitions, just sort of how high this guy shoots. So Malick is chiefly interested in the philosophy of phenomenology. Matt, do you know what phenomenology is?
You know, I'm not even going to try to pretend I've definitely heard the word before, but I could not define it for you.
Okay. So phenomenology is a school of philosophy that arose out of the early 20th century in not surprisingly, Germany, which is where a lot of 20th century philosophy and 19th century philosophy came from. So its father is a guy named Edmund Husserl, who unfortunately found himself in the midst of the rise of the Nazi Party and was also Jewish. So his career was essentially ended by the rise of Nazi Germany in his older age, I should say. But so he gave rise to this intellectual school that was includes people like Jean-Paul Sartre and Martin Heidegger, who actually took over from Husserl at the University of Freiburg as the chair of the philosophy department there. And the reason that Heidegger took over is because Husserl was essentially kicked out by the Nazi Party, and that Heidegger took over. Heidegger himself was a member of the Nazi Party, a fairly proud member of the Nazi Party. And Heidegger is a favorite of Malick's. So this is an interesting element of Terrence Malick, his association with this, really revered, the giant of 20th century philosophy in Heidegger. But he was a real acolyte of Heidegger's. And in fact, in 1969, published a translation of Heidegger's The Essence of Reasons, which was very well received. So phenomenology itself is the idea, essentially, that rather than focusing on the kind of causes of events is to focus on the experience of events, the phenomenon, mm-hmm. right? So it's a lot like existentialism, except it is really rooted in the idea of the individual experience of consciousness, right? And so, again, it's kind of highfalutin, right? But you can see how that plays out in a lot of the narratives that Malick puts forth in his films, that he is very much interested in the internal mind of his characters, right? And so that translates into his work as a filmmaker.
So it's kind of like the experience of living, you know, individual by individual, and characterizing that dynamic and how it might be similar or different among people. Is that kind of one of the ideas?
Yeah, I think so. I haven't read a lot of Heidegger. I was a philosophy and religion major in college, so I did read some, and I don't remember loving it. He really is sort of the guy I think who was most associated with phenomenology, and the idea basically, yes, is that, you know, existentialism is the philosophy that life's meaning is determined by the experiencer, mm-hmm. right? That there's no prescribed meaning to life, that it's something that you make through existence. Phenomenology is that there's no objective, necessarily, reality outside of the person experiencing that reality. And so the whole kind of instance of someone experiencing something, even if it's a big historical thing or a minor everyday thing, is really different person to person and determined by the whatever the person brings into that experience. And so it's that element that I think helps to kind of unlock some of what Malick does in his movies, and also why some people hate them.
Yeah, well, it's that kind of deep dive into the main character's state of mind that, you know, characterizes a lot of the work, which, you know, I'm sure that's something we'll get to in a second, but yeah. It's kind of what it's all about.
So with that in mind, all right, so for reasons that nobody can quite understand, somehow along the lines here, so he's teaching at MIT, he writes this translation of Heidegger, he is on the verge of becoming, you know, a major name probably in the philosophy world, and is like, I'll go to film school.
As you do, yeah. So
again, yeah, well, very similar to your experience as well, except you weren't teaching at MIT, but translating Heidegger before that. So Malick goes to film school for again, reasons that cannot be determined. He goes to the AFI Conservatory, graduates with an MFA in 1971, and this is at a time when film is kind of going through a transitional phase from the kind of old Hollywood studio system and your Clark Gables, and right where you have like these actors with contracts with studios, and they're really what's driving the whole industry, to artists coming in and putting their own, like directors putting their own influence onto these movies and reshaping what a movie can be. And you know, we see in the 70s like the renegade filmmakers, Brian De Palma's and Francis Ford Coppola and Steven Spielberg, right, towards the end of that era. I would imagine that's got something to do with it, that he was seeing in the film industry a sort of changing in changing of the guard, so to speak, and that maybe he saw an interesting way to explore his own philosophical ideas through film. But that's purely conjecture. I have no idea what drove Malick.
That was kind of like the age of the auteur, right, in American cinema, where it was like you were saying about the individual's, the artist's vision of what they wanted to create, as opposed to like the studio system. Okay, you're going to do, you know, an action picture now, and we're going to cast you, you know, for the next 6 years and that kind of thing.
Yeah, and the new wave movement had been happening, like in Jean-Luc Godard, and like there. So yeah, it certainly in this era, like 1971, is right smack in the middle of this period where clearly, like, what you can do with film and what you can make, and how you can go about making it. Is changing. And, you know, this is a completely different subject, but there's a fascinating story to be told as to how film got to be where it was, having to do with Thomas Edison and his insistence on copywriting and getting patents for absolutely everything. The Hollywood film system emerged out of people trying to get away from Edison and trying to get away from his lawsuits. And so this kind of thing got built around that, and then it gradually got dismantled, and Malick seems to be sort of in the middle of that dismantling. So 1973 is the release of his first film, Badlands, starring Martin Sheen and Sissy Spacek, both real staples of the kind of era of film that we're talking about. And it's in this movie that we start to see the sort of prototype, the ingredients that go into Malick movies. So we've got a lot of sweeping sort of natural cinematography, a lot of natural light. He loves to shoot his movies at certain times of the day, so they didn't get exactly the right light. You've got these two kind of renegade people on the run from the law, right, going through a kind of existential crisis. And then you also have the thing that makes him a true renegade, in that he commits the cardinal sin of filmmaking, his use of the voiceover, which he absolutely loves. So let's talk about voiceovers for a second, right? Now, you know that Malick uses voiceovers, that all of his movies, I think, essentially include quite a bit of voiceover. Voiceover has a real negative association because it is typically used as a kind of lazy crutch, right? So you can't tell the story with narrative and visually. You have to resort to busting into the person's head and pushing the story along that way.
Right.
Most of the time, that's how voiceover is used, right? A lot of the times it's used in sort of CBS drama TV shows or something like that, where, you know, the main character is sort of filling you in on what happened because you don't have time to tell the whole story. So you just got to like lay it all out through narration and voiceover. And that's not how Malick uses voiceovers.
I mean, I can see, you know, how some people might put people off. They might think it's too much. I mean, for example, when you watch The Thin Red Line, there really is an awful lot of voiceover there, and it's very rhapsodic. It's very questioning of God. It's like you're reading Augustine's Confessions or something, you know, asking about the nature of God and why do you do what you do? You know, but you know, for me, I think, you know, I like hearing the internal monologue of people because I think we all think, we don't always say what we think, but we wonder and we question. And, you know, in the context of this incredible natural world that he creates, especially in The New World, but also Tree of Life and other films, it seems like an appropriate kind of response to a world that does not totally make sense to you. And I think you see that in a lot of his films. So for me, with Malick's films, yeah, it works great. I mean, you know, when I watch Bad Boys 3, I don't need any... You know, I don't need any voiceover. And today it's kind of used as a joke, you know, think of Arrested Development, how brilliantly they did voiceover to make these cutting comments about each other. But, you know, for Malick, I think, you know, it's just a tool in his toolbox, and you can use it well or use it poorly. And, you know, for me, I think it's always most often really, really effectively done.
Yeah, it reminds me of the way that people justify having nudity or sex scenes in their movie because it's like, oh, it's important for the story. And it's, well, actually, in this case, it is, right? Like, like Malick can't actually tell the stories he wants to tell in the way that he wants to tell them without the voiceovers. And the voiceovers always, they're not just serving the purpose of driving the story along. They get us into the minds of the people that are experiencing these things. So yeah, I mean, I think you can argue that he found the exception to the rule of when voiceovers can be used. And I think as with any technique, you know, the run-on sentence, like Faulkner used to write sentences that would last a page, right? And like, as long as you do it right, as long as you have the right punctuation in there and it makes sense, then I don't think any rule should be ironclad, that you can violate rules all you want.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good analogy to writing because I think it seems like at heart, Malick's a writer. He's a thinker. And, you know, like a lot of these rules you learn when you're like in grade school, don't do run-on sentences, don't end sentences with prepositions. You know, they're good for when you're in school and a kid, but like when you're, you know, an adult, you should be able to break the rules and not feel like you have to be, you know, following the strictures of the elements of style or something when you're trying to, you know, say something. So, yeah, I completely agree.
Yeah. And I think that's a really good, to call him a writer, you know, when you say that, I initially kind of resist it because I'm like, well, is he a writer because is his writing great? And then I think, well, you know, I separate out writing from storytelling, and I don't think Malick is a great storyteller because I don't think he's actually a storyteller at all. And then I'm like, okay, so I think what he likes to do is find stories and explore them rather than tell them. So if you look at something like The Thin Red Line, it's an adaptation of a book, and you know, you look at something like The Tree of Life, and there's a lot of autobiography in that, and you look at something like in The New World, and it's he's taking history and he's exploring it his own way, right? So like his films are such wholesale pieces of art that it's really hard to pick one element that he's really good at the most, right? That because of all the component pieces working so well together. You know, it's different for someone like, I don't know, like Quentin Tarantino. Like, he's very clearly a writer. Like, he loves writing. He loves his dialogue. And I'm not, I can't say I love him or whatever. But, like, it's very clear that he kind of lives and dies by his writing, right? And I don't kind of feel that way about Malick.
That's true. Yeah, I should probably modify that to say, like, his origins as a writer, as a scholar, I suppose, you know, in some way must inform what he does visually. But yeah, I mean, I've read things in preparation for, you know, our talk today where, you know, actors will say they do get a script, but when they're shooting, they ignore the script. He just advises actors to use the writing as inspiration and take things where they may go. So he's definitely not the Tarantino kind of writer, but, you know, I feel like, you know, there's some kind of basis that informs what he does, obviously. It can't all just be happenstance. But again, that's like you were saying, this is a matter of conjecture and things I've pieced together from various places. I could be 100% wrong, but, you know, getting back to the voiceover, I feel that the characters are guiding you through the story. And even getting back to your point about phenomenology, you know, experiencing things as they happen through his films can be similar to what I think we feel like how we go through life at times, you know, unsure of ourselves and not knowing where we're going, really.
Yeah, let's get back to his life. So 1978 is when his second movie, Days of Heaven, is released. And Days of Heaven is probably a bigger, higher profile movie than Badlands. So it stars Richard Gere. It's one of Richard Gere's earlier movies. It is considered part of Richard Gere's greatest work. And I should say that I think Richard Gere is one of the greatest actors alive. Hmm. But he's one of those actors that also loves to just pick his own stuff and do his own thing and doesn't really love being a movie star, which is interesting because it sort of, that sounds like Malick, right? Days of Heaven comes out. It's really well received. It's a big, sweeping, epic movie. It's, again, a lot of the Malick tropes are in it. It's turn of the century Texas, a lot of natural light. And in fact, it was the natural light thing that seems to have been what caused a great deal of tension on the set. A lot of people quit this movie. A lot of people were really turned off to Malick and like refused to ever work with him again. And I can kind of understand why. So he shot almost all of the movie either at sunrise or sunset. So he used incredibly small windows, right, to film most of this movie because he really liked the natural effect of the lighting in those times. And that is not, like, when you're making a movie, that's not ideal for a crew. I can understand why the crew would get a little annoyed. I'm sure it was great for Richard Gere, who just got to, like, hang out all day in his trailer and just wait till 6 p.m. to go out and film for 20 minutes and then go home. But, you know, it was a big, epic movie. Malick notoriously likes to shoot a lot of film, and this movie seemed to have taken a very long time to make. He edited it for 2 years. So,
oh, wow. I had no idea.
So, yeah. anyway, came out in 78. I'm not sure when they started filming, but he wrapped up Badlands in 73, so you can kind of guess. And then he quit film for a long time and disappeared entirely for 20 years. And nobody's quite sure why. Maybe he also quit Malick. he moves to Paris. He starts writing this screenplay for a movie called Q, which never saw the light of day, but it was a movie that explored the origins of life. And Q itself would eventually kind of split off into two different movies. The Tree of Life is one of them, and The Voyage of Time, which is his documentary about the space-time continuum and all of the Earth and the universe that was released a couple years after The Tree of Life.
Yeah, it's kind of an amazing, you know, span of time to step away from, you know, a film that would already have seemed to have achieved in his young career probably so many of the goals he had as a, you know, visual storyteller. And yeah, I mean, it's fun to speculate. I think there was some rumor during that time that he was doing script doctoring,
right?
You know, punching and polishing up, you know, prominent, I guess, scripts for handsome fees, as I understand that world can sometimes offer. I mean, I want to think that, you know, he may have done commercial films too, you know, Weekends at Bernie or whatever under nom de plumes, but like, yeah, I'm sure it was for like big ticket kind of things. Who knows though, you know? So.
One day we'll finally get the Blu-ray yeah. Weekend at Bernie's Terrence Malick cut that we so deserve to see.
Yeah. And if someone who's listening happens to know, please be in touch with John.
I would love to know what Terrence Malick worked on in that time. Yeah, I doubt it's anything quite as interesting as Weekend at Bernie's. He's probably working on, you know, art films for French filmmakers or something. But
yeah, exactly. Yeah,
yeah. Who knows? I think a lot of his time really was spent writing this epic screenplay that never saw the light of day. Anyway, he comes back in 1998 and releases The Thin Red Line. So this was a much heralded return. Like, this is Hollywood loves this kind of a story, right? When they like get one of theirs back, and especially one who had this sort of promise as an auteur, right? And who goes missing. And it's like getting J.D. Salinger to write a sequel to Catcher in the Rye kind of thing, right? Like, we're like, you finally found him and pinned him down, and it's like, all right, keep making novels. And it's funny because Malick is given that kind of celebrity label as being a recluse, and anybody who knows him, it's that seems to not be the case at all. Like, he's very gregarious, he's very outgoing, he hangs out with people all the time. Huh. He just refuses to do the sort of like press junket thing, right?
Yeah.
He won't go on like Conan, and that makes him a that makes him a recluse in the eyes of Hollywood, which I think is pretty fascinating. But like, anybody who I guess can develop that kind of an arsenal of great work, right? I think you get a pass if you can, you know, always produce something interesting.
Yeah, when you look at the cast of The Thin Red Line as well, I mean, when you, right. You know, it's unbelievable. It's like a murderer's row of the 1990s. And, you know, so I think if you can get people like that to come to you, the studios are going to, you know, if you don't want to sit for E or whatever, and, you know, have, you know, do the press junket kind of thing, they're probably fine with it, right?
Yeah, it's people who've been in Malick movies are almost like people who've been in like the MCU, right? It's like literally everybody has been in it because they really want to be a part of this thing. And yeah, The Thin Red Line, I remember that even before the movie was released, when they were doing, and this may have been actually the cut that was released to festivals and that sort of thing, but the theatrical cut that was finally released to theaters had to cut a bunch of high named, like very high profile actors from the cast. One of them was Gary Oldman, who I'm sure he only had maybe like 5 minutes. Like, if you remember the movie, John Travolta's in it, but he's in it in one scene and it's like 5 minutes long, right? I'm pretty sure Oldman had a role like that, but he was cut. And if you're just cutting Gary Oldman from your movie, right, because you can't fit the Gary Oldman scene in there, that tells you what you need to know about the scope and the cast of this movie. And in fact, the cast members that anchor the movie really are not hugely well known, or, you know, I think they're more well known now, but at the time they were not necessarily massive anchoring stars. So you have this whole massive cast of Nick Nolte and Woody Harrelson and that sort of thing, but it's anchored by people like Jim Caviezel, Adrian Brody, Ben Chaplin, right? Like, these are the guys who are the stars of the thing.
Yeah.
So yeah, that also is kind of seems to be an avenue that Malick likes to take. He knows exactly how he wants to use his actors, and he doesn't just like stunt cast, which is sort of an interesting approach. Anyway, so Thin Red Line was the other World War II movie of that year, was a little bit drowned out by another World War II movie called Saving Private Ryan, which you might have heard of. Also a movie with like an enormous cast, but these are very, very different movies.
Yeah, completely different. Yeah, they're just, Yeah, they're war movies only in name, in terms of what they share, right?
Right,
So.
right. Yeah. Saving Private Ryan really is about the experience and the hell of war. It's very visceral. It's very kind of immediate, and it uses the terror, right? The sound and the visual sort of overwhelming element of the experience of the characters. I think in that way, there's something almost Malickian about it, that it really does try and get you to feel the experience of the characters. But The Thin Red Line uses World War II as a way to deal with existential angst, right? Like, whereas Saving Private Ryan is a movie that tries to get people to have some sort of feeling of what it is to be in a war like that. So they have very different motivations,
right.
And also Thin Red Line takes place in the Eastern, or the Eastern Theater, which is not where you typically see World War II movies. So regardless, Malick is lauded for coming back, and this movie makes a bunch of, you know, best of lists. So he gets nominated for Best Picture, Best Director, wins none of those things. Do you remember what won Best Picture that year?
That was the really bad year where, that was Shakespeare in Love, right?
Yeah.
Oh, good Lord.
The story of, like, why Shakespeare in Love won Best Picture that year and what was going on in terms of, and this is all about Harvey Weinstein. That Weinstein had sort of figured out a way to hack the Academy voting by doing the equivalent of essentially, like, flooding the airwaves, right, with political ads. And, like, Miramax just absolutely bombarded people with why you need to make this the best. It's weird that that would even work, but Weinstein figured out a way to get Shakespeare in Love to win Best Picture at a year when The Thin Red Line and Saving Private Ryan came out. It's just jaw-dropping to think of that.
Yeah, he really kind of redefined the Hollywood Oscar campaign with that. You know, I mean, it just really changed the terms of what you were supposed to do. And you know, it'd always been a competition for awards, I'm sure. And you know, print ads and whatever they do and sending out videos and stuff. But yeah, that was just like wall-to-wall kind of coverage. It kind of broke the Hollywood system in a way, but I don't know. That's, I guess, another matter. But it does seem a shame, you know, I mean, because, you know, who goes back to Shakespeare in Love these days? You know, I mean, right. You go back to, you know, The Thin Red Line. You go back to Saving Private Ryan. I mean, I guess, you know, awards have a purpose, but, you know, rewarding artistic merit, and I'm going to sound like an asshole for saying this, you know, is not necessarily the purpose of them. So
I thoroughly enjoyed Shakespeare in Love when I saw it as a
Oh, definitely.
Nerd.
Definitely. Yeah. Oh, totally.
I have never had any inkling to watch it again, like, after the first time. I've seen it once, and I was like, great, cool, good.
Yeah.
What fun. I've seen The Thin Red Line probably 5 times, right? And,
yeah.
And Saving Private Ryan I've seen a couple times. That's a harder one to actually get through.
Yeah, definitely is.
But The Thin Red Line, so that's another movie that sort of pushes forward what becomes the Malick recipe. So again, you have a lot of voiceovers, a lot of internal monologue, a lot of sort of musing on the experience of being a stranger in a strange place, trying to find some sort of peace and meaning in amidst chaos and a kind of an alien environment. And it's something that I think is really well explored in that story, but there's something about that story that is bigger than those ideas, if that makes any sense at all, that I don't think it's viewed, I think you and I agree on this, that it's not viewed I think you and I both think The New World is the best of the Malick movies, which is kind of the thesis of what we're going to be talking about here. But, you know, it's an adaptation of a book that was already made into a movie. It is a very, very loose adaptation. It's an adaptation in the sense that if he had not credited the book, he would have been sued, but that's about it. But it shoots really, really high, and it's the story itself is separated over so many different characters that it spends less time getting into the minds of the individual characters and more time getting into the existential meaning of the story. It has more in common with, like, Candide, right? Which I think is probably something that Malick has read a number of times.
Mm-hmm.
And the the idea of like finding Eden, right? Finding a perfect world, or I don't know. How would you say it?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely has the Edenic. Is that the right way to say it?
Edenic is a word, yeah.
Yeah, the Edenic qualities, you know, that have appeared in other of his movies. A Hidden Life, which is his most recent film, also deals with, you know, similar kind of contexts in which a pure location is violated by a kind of invasion of evil. And in this case, I don't think it's so much evil in a new world, because I don't think the English explorer's intentions are presented as evil, and certainly not from an historical perspective were they meant to be evil. But, you know, this sort of conflict, and something is lost or ruined that can't be regained again, not just in terms of what happens to the land and the people involved, the English versus the Powhatan native people, you know, but between the relationship between Pocahontas and Smith. So yeah, there's, you know, the state of perfection, you know, can't last, I suppose. It's obviously one of the oldest stories in the Western canon, at least.
Right. And I think that that's a really great way of saying it. I think in the Thin Red Line, what you have is it uses war as a way of talking about the way that mankind and nature are often at odds, but then also are one and the same, right? And I think that's also one of the underlying themes of Malick.
Yeah,
it's a very strange way to use war, but. And I think that's also one of the reasons why The Thin Red Line, a lot of people were like, what? Right? Like, this is a war movie. Why is everybody talking to themselves and swimming in the ocean and like, yeah, hanging out with native people on a weird island? Like, what is this? Yeah. So, you know, the anybody in any environment, as soon as they enter into that environment, in any other means aside from birth, right, mm-hmm. is going to disrupt it and change it. And how you deal with that sort of disharmony and what that disharmony means and if it can be reharmonized, right? I think that's sort of what's going on a lot in The Thin Red Line. And I think war is obviously a sort of exaggerated version of that, that I think is, again, much more sophisticated in A New World because it's so specific to the characters, whether it's Pocahontas and Smith and then Pocahontas and Rolf and Pocahontas in her native environment versus Pocahontas in England, right? Mm-hmm. That you have it's the pieces are easier to sort of navigate and move around. But we'll come back to that in a second. Let's just talk really quickly about A New World and what happens to Malick's career. So a mere 7 years go by between The Thin Red Line and The New World. I'm sure all of it spent actually making the movie or maybe editing the movie or whatever.
Yeah.
And my suspicion is that one of the reasons that Malick came back to film in 98 was a technology reason, that a lot of the things that had been sort of a nuisance to him or a hindrance to him were no longer an issue, right? Like, this is the sort of the dawn of digital filming, and you can film's a lot cheaper and you can waste a lot more of it. And at this point, like, I didn't even need it anymore. And you can edit things on a computer. And like, I'm sure a lot of that to Malick was like, oh, cool. Making the movies I want to make now is going to be a lot easier.
Right.
Still hard, but easier than mm-hmm. it was in the 1970s. Purely conjecture on my part. I have absolutely no idea if that's why, right? But it seems to me like, oh, yeah, we live in an age now where the kind of movies that Malick wants to make are easier to make. I don't think he's, you know, using too many green screens or whatever, but
yeah. And so much of what he does, you know, happens in the editing room. So, you know, for that to be facilitated more easily with technology, you know, probably may account for like his recent quicker output of movies, you know, which is certainly heartening for those of us who love his movies to see.
Yeah. And it's weird because he will, like, he'll do the thing where he goes 7 years and then he'll just like make three in a row.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
It's a very strange schedule he seems to be on. It's like the older he gets, the more urgent it is that he makes movies. It reminds me of Ridley Scott in that way.
Where, oh, yeah.
Ridley Scott's like 500 years old and every every 20 minutes he's like, and then I'm going to make this epic. And I'm like, dude, slow down. like, you don't need to. So Hidden Life came out in 2019. Two short films in 2018. Song to Song and something called Notes of a Woman, which was also a short film. Both of those in 2017. Voyage of Time was 16. Knight of Cups was 15. To the Wonder was 12. Tree of Life was 11. So there's 6 years between The New World and Tree of Life. And then just a whole bunch of output as this guy is, you know, approaching 80 years old. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, maybe he's feeling some of that existential angst that he explores so much in his movies, in his drive to make as many movies as possible. But okay, so New World comes out. We'll get back to that in a second. Tree of Life is probably his most commercially successful movie. Mm-hmm. Part of the reason why it was so big was probably because it starred Brad Pitt and Sean Penn, especially Brad Pitt, who 2011, almost 10 years ago, still one of the biggest, most bankable stars in America. And this is one of the first of his really kind of interesting, I'm going to do my own thing and make art movies transitions that he seems to have made in the last 10 years or so.
Yeah, it's been heartening to see. I mean, you know, someone with, you know, his looks and charisma could have done, you know, Batman or something, you know, similar like that. But he's had a hugely successful career, you know, taking some left turns when people probably would have expected him to just do the straight and narrow thing. So
it's interesting because, again, I think Brad Pitt is kind of like our modern Richard Gere in a lot of ways, where there's definitely the kind of Hollywood pretty boy sex symbol whatever element of him, but mm-hmm. underneath, like, is a real performer, actor, artist who really wants to do his own thing and wants to navigate his own path. I think we've seen, we kind of got hints of that when Brad Pitt did 12 Monkeys in 1996, you know, that we saw like, oh, this isn't just a guy who is the pretty boy who's going to be the anchor of all of these kind of studio, right? Like blockbuster, mm-hmm. The movie that makes back the studio's budget for the year, right? Like Will Smith yeah. was for a few, you know what I mean? Like that's,
yeah, he could have been, yeah, the guy who was paying the bills for everyone else. Right. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, he worked with Malick. He worked with Fincher. He worked with, you know, Redford. So, yeah, I mean, credit to him for seeking out the good stuff.
Fincher a couple times. Yeah. Because yeah, Fight Club and then Benjamin Button.
The Head in the Box movie. Yeah, Benjamin Button. Yeah, which
and Seven,
I love.
Of course. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and yeah. Seven. Jeez. Yeah. Oh,
wow. Yeah.
I love Benjamin Button, just as a side note, man. I freaking love that movie. Oh, wow.
Anyway, so Tree of Life is, so there's a funny story about Tree of Life, actually. I found this thing, and I remember this being an issue. I remember hearing about this on NPR when this movie came out. So it's a Brad Pitt movie, right? And it's a Brad Pitt movie with Sean Penn in it, and it's advertised on television, and you see these scenes of, you know, this family in the 50s in Texas, and it looks like a normal movie. And then you go into the movie, and it's 3 hours long, and it starts with dinosaurs, and you're like, what, what is going on? So again, part of that sort of transition for Brad Pitt was this movie that a lot of people went to go see a Brad Pitt movie and then were like, why am I watching dinosaurs? And why is the universe being created? Like, so one particular movie theater, the Avon Theater in Stamford, Connecticut, had to put a disclaimer about the movie. And this made the Twitter repost verse and then also NPR. And the disclaimer reads as follows. Dear patrons, in response to some customer feedback and a polarized audience response from last weekend, we would like to take this opportunity to remind patrons that The Tree of Life is a uniquely visionary and deeply philosophical film from an auteur director. It does not follow a traditional linear narrative approach to storytelling. So far, they've just described Terrence Malick, right? We encourage patrons to read up on the film before choosing to see it. And for those electing to attend, please go in with an open mind and know that the Avon has a no-refund policy once you have purchased a ticket to see one of our films. The Avon stands behind this ambitious work of art and other challenging films which define us as a true art house cinema, and we hope you will expand your horizons with us. Thank you.
Wow.
which is interesting because, like, it's Tree of Life played everywhere, right? I think it played in sort of the art house theaters maybe first. It had a pretty wide release. But it's interesting that, like, an art house theater had to be like, this is not just a Brad Pitt movie. Like, don't come to our art house theater to go see a Brad Pitt movie. You know, like, yeah, they use a lot of the same words that we have used to describe Malick in this disclaimer, but I remember finding that hilariously funny when I heard about it on the NPR piece.
Yeah, I mean, it's you can see how people might not have known what to expect on the one hand, but you know, if you're going to an art house movie theater might tip you off a little bit, but it's not the multiplex. But you know, again, people. You know, I can't blame people for having negative reactions to movies, but, you know, we all experience things, like we were saying before, in different ways. But, yeah, this, you know, obviously Malick's not to everyone's taste.
No.
I personally love the movie. I thought it was a revelation, and I've seen it many times since.
Yeah, no, I, for sure. I think it's one of his best movies. I definitely go back and forth between, I mean, The Thin Red Line definitely has a special place in my heart, my, like, you know, in terms of I was, let's see, 19 when that came out, and you know, and it was one of the, it was also on the verge of, like, 1999 was one of the greatest movie years ever. When you look back at the movies that came out that year, it was so revolutionary. There was just so much crazy good movies going on that year, and 98 was kind of a, you know, a lead up to it. I remember that The Thin Red Line was the first movie that I saw that I really felt kind of challenged by as a late teenager. And so that it definitely has a real, you know, special place. But The New World is definitely the one that speaks to me on a personal kind of gut level the most. But on a sort of intellectual, spiritual level, The Tree of Life is that movie. New World is the one I would most readily go back and watch, but Tree of Life is the one that maybe has the most emotional impact.
Yeah, I think so too. And, you know, a lot of that for me when I watched The Tree of Life, which I saw a couple months ago, you know, just the performance between the actors and depicting these tensions between, you know, father and son and wife and husband, you know, the disappointments people feel in their lives. A lot of that's very, you know, you wonder how much of that might be personal to the filmmaker, but it's conveyed beautifully by the actors, which ultimately is what matters. You know, I'm still a little baffled about the Sean Penn stuff towards the end, but I think I kind of get it. I can't admit to, like, don't ask me too much about that if we do this again, but, you know.
I think I kind of get it element of Malick is part of the point. I think that's also part of the point of Phenomenology. At its core, there's something to not get about Malick. Do you know what I mean, though? There isn't a right answer. It does really depend on what you're bringing into what you're seeing. And I think that's part of his genius, is that he is really able to create films that are at once incredibly intellectual and philosophical, but also incredibly personal, but also universal in a way that whatever anybody takes away from it is the right thing to take away from it, right? Like that's almost the formula of what he does, which is very philosophy professor of him.
Yeah, it's a good point. I mean, you can just kind of let parts of his movie just happen to you, you know, and you don't necessarily have to think every second and try to figure things out. Although his movies may prompt you to do that at times, you know, you just kind of let it happen. You know, his scenes of nature, wind rustling over grass or through the trees or a stream going through, you know, parts of the landscape, you know, to me, those are just like little moments of reflection in his movie. And you just kind of like let them happen and, you know, just tune out for a little bit even. So, and again, like, I'm not a movie expert, but I don't, you know, who else does that?
Yeah. And when I think of the other kind of philosophy directors, like Christopher Nolan is one of those directors who, like, oh, this thing that I'm making has a meaning, and if you don't get it, you're an idiot. And there's something that I don't know. I've never watched a Christopher Nolan movie that I wasn't entertained by. I think The Prestige is probably his best movie, and I think it's probably its least appreciated movie as well. Because that's the movie that really kind of walks that line the best. But then I think of a movie like Inception, and you get all these like fanboys being like, oh my God, it's the most interesting movie ever made. And if you don't get it, you're an idiot. And it's like, yeah, is it though? Like, you know, is it really as smart as you think it is? Because... it's a kind of an interesting conceit that doesn't actually have much to it and has a lot of window dressing to make it seem smarter than it really is.
Mm-hmm.
I understand why people feel talked down to by a lot of these auteur directors, right? I understand why people feel like they're inaccessible because these people think they're smarter than the audience.
Mm-hmm.
I happen to like a lot of those movies because I'm a nerd, but like I get why people don't and I get when people don't like a really sort of obtuse and ambiguous movie when I do, and I don't try and like force that on them. But I think with Malick, it's if you do give it a chance, as the Avon Theater in Stamford, Connecticut asked you to, if you do kind of give it a chance and just kind of let it happen to you and realize that there isn't a right interpretation of it, and that the fact that there's no right interpretation of it rewards multiple viewings, and that, you know, you can watch it 9 times and see something different every time, and like that is what Malick believes in as a philosophy. You know, I think there's something really beautiful and wonderful and almost impossible about that, that just nobody else has that ability.
Yeah, and yeah, I totally agree. And I, you know, I've gotten that sense before from, you know, Nolan's films, but also other films. I mean, it's, you know, the expectation that you're going to be entertained or understand every director's kind of work, you know, and, you know, most people don't care who the director is, but they have the experience of a movie theater of being like, I don't get what they're trying to do, or I can't figure out this puzzle in Inception, which I certainly couldn't. I mean, don't, you know, yeah. My life depended on it. I couldn't explain that movie, but that's fine. Like, I don't get bent out of shape about it, and nor do you, but like, yeah, it's tougher, even, you know, as the years go on, maybe for filmmakers like that to do their work, because so much of what is made is geared towards, let's make the audience happy. And that's always been true in theater and movies. But now, you know, people get really upset if something happens in a movie and a portion of the fan base doesn't like it, obviously. So I don't know. I like being subject to the whims of a director, whomever that person might be, whether it's, you know, I want to see Little Women and Greta Gerwig's work more, and I want to see newer directors. And I care about, like, what an artist says. Like, I'm the viewer. Like, this is the bargain we've made. Like, you know, you've made the movie and I chose to see it. You know, and those are the terms of engagement. I want to see what you have to say. I don't get a vote in it. I don't know. I guess I'm old fashioned.
I don't know. 100% with you. I think we see this most with Star Wars nerds who are like,
yeah, exactly.
Give me this one particular cut that I, you know, like, just watch it. Whatever. It's Star Wars, man. Get over it. Right. Like, anyway, we both love Star Wars. We're both complete.
I love Star Wars. Right. Of course, I adore it.
Yeah. So, okay. Yeah. Let's get back to, okay, one more thing before we go any further. I do want to address the is Terrence Malick a Nazi element of it. So Terrence Malick is a stan of this one particular Nazi philosopher, Heidegger, whose philosophy, by the way, is not like Nazi philosophy. He just was a member of the party, as pretty much everybody who wasn't Jewish in his time and place was, you know, to sort of questionable amount of loyalty to the party. Whatever. Heidegger's philosophy has nothing to do with Nazism. You might even say that, like, Nietzsche, who was, you know, definitely nothing to do with Nazism, but more influential, is more associated with Nazism than someone like Heidegger is.
Right.
And you, whether or not you can separate the work from the author, you know, that's a whole different conversation. we've talked about this before, that Malick also likes Wagner, and that's also problematic in the association with Nazi.
Yeah, you know, the examples seem to pile up, so I can see how it would be concerning to people.
But then you get to the most recent movie, A Hidden Life, as you've already alluded to, and A Hidden Life is a movie about a conscientious objector to the Nazis. So that's that's, I think, Malik making his definitive, like, where I stand with Nazis stamp, right?
Explicitly clear.
Right. Here's this glowing movie about this guy who stood up to the Nazis. But I think there's something even more interesting there, which is that one of the things I love about Malik, and this will get us, I think, into the new world, is his lack of judgment. And I don't think in an irresponsible way. I don't think he's like, well, Hitler was just experiencing life. It's, you know, I don't think that.
No.
But that he's not interested in making assessments on history so much as trying to understand not the big driving forces of historical events, but the personal driving forces. That, like, history is something that happens to people. And by people, that human beings with internal monologues and individual experiences of reality are the people that make history happen. And we often, I mean, you're a historian, so you can, I'd love to hear what you have to say about this, but do you mind if I call you a historian? You have a PhD in history, so I'm going to call you that. So I think you officially get the title. I'd love to hear what you have to say about this. I've always been really allergic to the great man of history sort of motif. Mm-hmm. And what I love about Malik is that when he explores history, he explores it from that vantage point of people did this. These were human beings who were not fundamentally unlike anybody else.
Yeah, exactly. You know, he doesn't make, you know, the thin red line about MacArthur, you know, for instance. You know, it's about this, you know, platoon or battalion of everyday soldiers. And, you know, likewise, even, you know, if you know a little bit about Virginian history, it's, you might know John Smith and you certainly know Pocahontas from having been in school and stuff. But they're kind of small figures on the stage, but that stage becomes bigger because of their interaction with it. And you might say that of other films too. I think the great man of history approach is definitely not what Malick's interested in. But somehow life becomes bigger even when they're in the smaller context of these people that he's dealing with. That for me makes it more powerful as a viewer, you know. It's a credit to him. And again, you know, showing us how people view and see the world and also how life changes when they interact with each other is, you know, takes on profound meaning for him.
Yeah. So the film itself, again, is sort of a middle point between Malick's return and then his explosion of work in the late part of the first decade of the 2000s. I don't even know how to refer to that. The 2010, the turn of the 2010s, I guess.
2010s, yeah.
Anyway, so 2005, this is his only movie between the end of the 90s and the beginning of the 2010s. And it's a movie that is, at the center of it, is the well-known, well-worn Disney adaptationed story of Pocahontas and John Smith, or kind of, right? So John Smith is a character in it. Pocahontas is a character in it. They do interact. There is something that happens between the two. She never sings a song about painting with wind or whatever. She is played by an actress who had not done anything before that, who was 14 years old when she played that role. Pocahontas at the time of her encounter with Smith would have been, it depends on how you read history, but 12-ish?
Yeah.
So, okay, can you give us a little bit about, historically, what does the film cover, and your understanding or your sort of analysis of its historical value or accuracy?
It's those first ships that were sent out as part of, you know, England's attempt to develop permanent colonies, which they had tried twice before and failed twice before. So, you know, 1607, when those ships set out, and, you know, I think the history is pretty good. You know, there definitely was encounters between the characters you see in the film, between Smith and Pocahontas. What really happens, like, historically, is there's one scene in the movie where, you know, Smith gives himself up almost as a prisoner to the chief of the Powhatan people and lives with them for a time. And in one scene, he's brought before the chief, and it seems like some of the other members of the tribe are going to kill him. And what happens in the film is that Pocahontas prevents this from happening. In other words, Smith was about to die. He's saved by Pocahontas. Historically, what Smith had done was write about that incident. And he wrote, the first time he wrote about it was soon after it actually happened. But he says he was brought before the king the first time he writes about it, but he says nothing about Pocahontas or anyone saving his life. It's 15 or 16 years later where he actually writes that story that I was saved by the princess or the chief's daughter who saved my life. And sort of it's from there, that second later account, that we get the Smith, the supposed Smith and Pocahontas relationship. But overall, the history is really good in the film, you know, from what I can tell.
Mm-hmm. Well, Smith himself was something of a notorious, like, self-aggrandizing fabulous, right? I mean, not uncommon of people of his ilk.
No, definitely not.
Right?
Definitely not.
That you're a guy who's trying to, you know, you're risking your life every time you get on a boat, and you're going somewhere where, you know, God knows what's going to happen to you when you get there. And, you know, he's certainly made a lot of enemies in a lot of different places and all that sort of thing. So, yeah, I think from what I understand, the general consensus among historians is that Smith either made this story up because it sounded good for him,
mm-hmm.
or I've also heard the theory that it did in fact happen, but it was something that the Powhatan sort of staged as a way of sort of creating this peace offering, right? By like having Pocahontas, they were never going to kill him in the first place, and Pocahontas threw herself on in front of him to sort of force a kind of a peace treaty with the English. I don't know how do you read that?
I mean, I think it's possible. There may have been symbolic meaning in that event when he's brought before Chief Powhatan. Basically what, you know, the Powhatan people believed was that they would kind of either send off these new groups of arrivals who would move along and get out of the Powhatan's people, you know, get out of the way of the Powhatan people, or that, you know, basically the Powhatan would control the English settlers, because Powhatan himself, you know, ruled over a number of other smaller groups or tribes as we would understand them. So they kind of assumed the English would just become under, you know, the Powhatan dominion. Of course, the English think the exact opposite, and hence a lot of the trouble in the movie. So that, again, that's portrayed pretty well because you see both those dynamics in the film.
Yeah, and that to me, I think, is one of the most sort of revelatory things. I mean, I don't think Malick is necessarily interested in redefining history or providing enormous historical insights. But I do think that in this case, he does, by, again, taking that sort of neutral observer stance that I think is one of his hallmarks, that he is able to point out that the desire for power and influence is not one-sided, right? Like, you do have these invaders who show up on your land, but it's not that they were, you know, all of the native people were defenseless entirely or mm-hmm. or not interested in maybe like using this as an opportunity to expand their own power. And we tend to, because we have a sort of, yeah, this gets into the nature of history itself, right? That what we think of as history, I think after a certain amount of time, we think of as being an objective record of the facts.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, as someone who studied history, like, that's not what we have. We don't have some guy. And I kind of feel like this is the sort of mental picture most people have, is that, like, there's some dude with a notebook, right, who's just like watching all of this stuff happen and writing it all down and then like sending it off to the history lab or something, and like that's what gets printed in our textbook. And that's not the case at all, right? Like, what we know of this incident, we know from Smith and we know from the colonists and from, you know, royal records and that sort of thing. So we lose that, like, yeah, there was motivations on the other side as well, and they are interested in the same things that all human civilizations are interested in, like conquest and power and dominion, right?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And the Powhatan people, you know, had become so powerful for those very reasons. You know, they had conquered, sometimes peacefully, sometimes violently, other tribes throughout, you know, that part of Virginia, and were quite powerful, and, you know, lorded it over some people and, you know, treated others well. I mean, the equivalencies only go so far, but yeah, absolutely. They have, you know, those Powhatan people had complex motives just as the English did and sought to get the best out of the other group. It worked out the way it did, obviously, as we know, to the English advantage with, you know, horrific consequences down the line. But yeah, you know, they didn't know that at the time, obviously. So, but yeah, I mean, getting back to Malick, though, yeah, he, you know, he uses the history as a starting point and is respectful of the scholarship as well as a filmmaker can be. But yeah, you can't be constrained by the sources in this case, because like you said, the sources are incredibly incomplete. So the sources, for a filmmaker's point of view, at least, only do so much.
Right. And you know, his desire to sort of get into people's heads, I think, is really helpful as a, you know, trying to, if not creating a new historical record, at least giving us a way of reassessing the existing historical record.
Mm-hmm.
That by allowing us the chance to just sort of entertain the idea of they're not being white hats and black hats, as there often is in the way that history is told. You know, however it's told, that tends to be the arrangement. Mm-hmm. By defying that and kind of throwing that away and focusing instead on discovery and the desire for discovery and to seek out new places and that really being the drive of the human experience, right? That, like, we love having security and we love having certainty, mm-hmm. but we thrive on breaking out of that, right, and kind of hoping things go well, because we have the sense that there is something more beyond, right? That we want to go to the moon, that we want to go beyond the moon, that we want to go, right? And, like,
yeah,
North America was the moon of the 17th century. He uses this moment in history as a way of telling something that is, again, uniquely and by definition, a human experience.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, profoundly so in this case. And, you know, the exploration that, you know, goes on, like you were saying, goes on from both sides, that we see. And it's kind of a remarkable achievement that it's not, you know, single-sided. But again, I think that goes to, you know, Malick's interest in just humankind and experience, and letting these explorations happen on screen so that we, you know, we see a remarkable portrait of two people who kind of in microcosm are capturing one of the great transformations of the past 400 years. The history, you know, again, you have to be respectful of it because these were actual people who lived and breathed. But, you know, the filmmaker's, you know, perspective and the filmmaker's obligation, you know, is different than a historian. Like you said, this, you know, he's not trying to settle or stimulate a historiographical debate on the one hand. On the other hand, you know, you have to be attentive to, you know, the actors and peoples involved. And I think he does that.
Yeah. And I also, what I think is really kind of powerful about this movie and what sets it apart is that the focus of it really is not the traditional adventurer, explorer, discoverers being the English arriving in Jamestown, but rather Pocahontas exploring and discovering something new with her encounter with Smith,
mm-hmm.
which, again, you know, okay, so we can talk about the ickiness of the sort of traditional Smith narrative, with that, you know, Smith, I think, wrote about how this girl was enchanted by him and blah blah blah, and maybe and we again, like, we don't know, I don't think we can say for sure how old Pocahontas actually was. We just don't know, like, how the Powhatan kept time, or if, like, there was there's no way of knowing that, right? We can't say for sure, like, the year she was born. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you can refute that, but as far as I know, we don't have any concrete evidence of exactly how old Pocahontas was, right?
Yeah, as far as I know, yeah.
We only have kind of Smith's account of it, and it seems like he was kind of guessing. So, you know, you have Colin Farrell playing Smith, and he's in his 30s at the time, and you have Corianka Kilcher playing Pocahontas, and she's 14, and the sort of the electricity between them, the love between them is not explored physically really in the movie. Like they never kiss in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
They are it's all about sort of this new thing, this like alien, right? It reminds me of like Elliot and E.T. in a certain way, right? That's like it's not romantic, but it is profound in its connection, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the way that that's done, I think, is remarkable. And then she marries John Rolfe, played by Christian Bale, and that plays out. And all the time, Malick is giving her agency in a way that I don't think history does, and I don't think any other account of this story ever has either.
Yeah, I think that's a really important part of the movie because, you know, you would think with a star on the rise like Colin Farrell was during that time, you know, it would be explicitly about him as the protagonist and like his journey and what that meant, and that was the dramatic action. But as the movie unfolds, it becomes really her movie. She is the protagonist. She is the one to whom a lot happens, but to whom makes decisions on her own and demands for herself. And you see that especially through the relationship with Rolfe, which was recorded. Obviously, you know, Rolfe and her were married. They did have a child together. They did go back to England together. You know, and there's like a kind of turn or transition in the film where you see that happen. And when she takes over, it's really kind of extraordinary because you're like, yeah, this whole experience, you know, seen through her point of view is kind of what is really most affecting about the film, I think, because it's her journey, it's her transformation that is the crucial one.
Yeah.
I think.
And yeah, there's a lot of living descendants of the relationship between Pocahontas and John Rolfe.
To the present day, is that right?
I didn't know that.
I didn't know that.
I'm pretty sure Nancy Reagan was one of them.
Is that right? Oh, wow.
I don't know. I have to look it up. I know there's some pretty high profile people who are well known to be. Descendants.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah, so you're right. It is something that is, we have a far more of a sort of solid basis for that relationship and understanding it. But what I really like is that she, like the way it talks about her exposure to Christianity and you know, again, I don't think Malick wants to downplay this, and I'm not downplaying it either, because absolutely there were lots of people who were just like forced to convert to Christianity and that's a really dark story. But she seems to, like, the way that he plays it is not, yes, there was some sort of coercion. I mean, she's married to this guy as a Christian and that's just the way things are done, and it doesn't seem like she really has a choice. But she also is very clearly discovering something new, and he really focuses on the fact that she is discovering something new, that she is learning, she's opening herself up to a new world, right? And mm-hmm. that is an exciting and motivating element for her, and I think that's a really important thing to capture. Again, if aliens invaded Earth, right, like we would all be terrified, but also like we all really want an alien invasion somewhere deep down. Right, I mean, like we're all sort of pining for that to some degree. As much as you're like, it's a horrifying idea, like we all want to like go on a spaceship and see what that's like, and like be exposed to their technology and maybe like forced to worship their god. I don't know, but right, like, but there is still something that really is. We wouldn't keep telling this story about alien invasions mm-hmm. if we weren't endlessly kind of both fascinated by it, but also kind of driven to it. And I think that Malick really wants to explore that really narrow pathway that she became a Christian, yes, kind of by coercion, but also that process was itself an element of discovery, and that she, when she went to England, like that cost her her life. But the mm-hmm. movie ends with her kind of dancing about, right, in a garden in England, and that's mm-hmm. what we're left with sort of just prior to her death, because it seems for Malick, and I you know, that his, where he finds meaning in the story is that drive, like she's found not Eden but something mm-hmm. new and like it's the looking for something new that matters, not the finding somewhere perfect.
Yeah, exactly, you know, finding that place of belonging that maybe isn't the native place where you grew up. I mean, it's a pretty common experience in human history, right? I mean, people spreading out from the first human settlements in Africa to other parts of the world and all the other, you know, manifestations of that across human history. I mean, and I think even if that scale isn't taken in the movie, you know, her experience of wanting to see where Rolf was from and wanting to develop relations in Virginia positively with the English settlers, you know, she goes to them during that winter when things are really bad and basically saves them, you know, and the haggard, shambolic men are like, princess, princess, princess. So there's an impulse like to make connections, to explore, yeah, that are not just like the provenance of like Western white people, right? So like, it's, we're not the only ones who got to do that. And I think there's some recognition of that in this work to a small degree. But yeah, you know, the scenes with Rolf and with Smith towards the end of the movie are really compelling because of, you know, we're seeing the choices that Pocahontas made up to that point, which, you know, are her own.
Well, let's talk about the ending. It's a real gut punch. The encounter with Smith at the end, is it true that Rolf set that up or that she did, in fact, encounter him in England? Or is that sort of apocryphal?
That I don't know. I thought that was fictional, kind of as a way for the filmmaker to wrap up, you know, this like almost divided love triangle. So I'm not sure about that.
If I remember right, like, and you know, I haven't really dug much into the story historically in quite some time, but I do remember that she does find out that he wasn't dead, that she's told that she was told that he died, but she found out that he wasn't. And I think that's also documented. I don't know if the re-encounter is historical or not, as I said, but if not, then what do you make of why Malick would want to include it?
You know, I think about that, those final like 20 minutes or so of the movie, you know, as the ones that really kind of, you know, just made me realize what a special film it is. And when Smith and Pocahontas meet again at this, you know, English country estate, you know, she asks him, you know, John, did you find your Indies, as in your West Indies, you know, whatever you were searching for? And he says, you know, I think, you know, they may have passed me by. And I think he's expressing the regret that he had left her to go back to England and missed on his chance, which, you know, Rolf kind of is his replacement in a sense. And Rolf, in setting up that meeting towards the end of the film, you know, I think he does so because he realizes that his wife is still conflicted about her feelings for Smith when she learns he's still alive. You know, and she says to him, in a way of saying thanks, I think, you are the man I thought you were. She says that to Rolf, for kind of giving her the chance to, I don't know, find closure, I suppose. Yeah, so it's kind of like a wrap-up almost of this exploration and questing, and then finding peace with Rolf and having a child with him, which, you know, tragically is cut off short because of her illness and eventual death. So,
yeah, and again, I think that's probably, whether or not it happened is inconsequential to Malick, because what matters to him, again, is the human experience of history and not necessarily the big, broad, right? Like, that he needs these characters to be able to have a... You know, it's funny. So let me back up for a second. For a guy who uses voiceover as a way of doing this most of the time, like, sometimes you actually need to have the characters have that interaction, whether or not they did, right? Because that's how he explores what's going on internally, by making something external happen. And I think that's really interesting. I think it sort of adds to his credibility as a guy who uses voiceovers, that he's like, you know what, even if this didn't happen, I need it to be there, because I need to really pay respect to this person's experience, and I can't do that unless I show them having this conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, completely. So it's like these consciousness, he's giving voice to consciousness in a way, and people's intimate thoughts, and how they crisscross and connect and don't connect. And finally, at the end of this film, there is a real connection made, surprisingly, between Rolf and Pocahontas, which is maybe not what you would expect at the start of the film, but you know, it adds an element of poignancy and tragedy and closure to the film that otherwise might have searched for a satisfactory kind of conclusion, but it was already, you know, that was part of the what actually happened. So but it ends with that kind of like real graceful note that is bittersweet, you know, to put it simply, I guess.
So we'd be remiss if I didn't talk about a couple things in wrapping up here. So first of all, I know you've read the piece by John Patterson in The Guardian at the end of 2009. So John Patterson is a film critic, and he wrote a piece in The Guardian, which has been pretty well read, called The New World, A Misunderstood Masterpiece, where he basically, in what seems like a fever dream drunk like it's the way that he talks about this movie is as though it is the most consequential event of a human being's life that you can find the words for, and actually like every word of it rings true, and I you know, when I read this I was like yeah definitely I feel this way too. it is a must read, and a great argument for why this movie, which he basically says is the movie of the aughts, the 2000s through 2031st 2009s. This is the defining movie of that time. I think, like so many of Malick's movies, it wasn't appreciated the way that it is in retrospect. That a lot of his movies don't get understood or are not digested properly upon first viewing, and a lot of people need a couple of years to sort of be like, oh wait, that movie was amazing. which is funny, because I think the Tree of Life is again the exception to that rule, where like people just loved it or hated it, and really very little of that opinion seems to have changed over time, but every other movie that Malick makes, there's always some kind of a reassessment, mm-hmm. one way or another. I gotta read my favorite line from this. So he says, "Suffice to say, The New World is not, as you may have read, a gooey specimen of incontinent pictorialism, nor a quote Tony Scott movie on quaaludes." So this itself awesome. Is just a fantastic read, and I certainly will link to it. From the Facebook page. The other thing that we have to talk about with Terrence Malick, because you can't have a conversation about Terrence Malick without talking about Bird Sounds. So let's just talk about Bird Sounds real quick. So the bird sounds in A New World are probably the best of all the bird sounds in all of Terrence Malick's movies, and also maybe play the most significant role, because this is the only movie that he sets in sort of the distant past where you would have more prominent bird sounds than you would in the post-industrialized world where most of his movies take place. So you're a bird enthusiast yourself, and I know that you have taken up birding, mm-hmm. and that you have said is an interesting subculture.
Yeah.
Is your love for birds part of your love for Terrence Malick, or is that just something that is purely coincidental?
Yeah, it's mostly coincidental, but it's kind of impossible to miss, I think, especially in this movie. You know, just as one of the oral sounds and his mastery of using music and ambient noise in the naturalistic way, like he shoots the films themselves. So I think the sounds, you know, just of nature, to put it generally, are an important part of the film. Instead of, you know, having, well, there's a lot of music in his movies. I'm not going to say that. You know, there's tons of the Vorspiel from, you know, Das Rheingold, you know, dominates through this film, and it's incredibly gorgeous. But I just love the way, I mean, the bird sounds for me, why it made such an impression was just the way the movie ends, right? It, like the stuff in England ends, and then it's just a scene back in Virginia. And all you hear really are just the bird sounds, and the images from where you had been back in Eden, to end the movie is just like so subtle but powerful to me. I don't know, to me it doesn't necessarily have a meaning, but it just goes back to the feeling and experience of being in this world he creates. That's just perfect for me. I mean, my interest in birding is just to, like, a, you know, appreciate that actually in Manhattan we have tons of bird species, and it's a fun thing to do on Saturday and Sunday mornings once we get back to normal. So yeah, it was kind of just like a coincidental kind of thing. But yeah, just, you know, just like I was alluding to before, the sounds, the simple sounds of a place, life goes on, irrespective of what's happening between the English and the Powhatan people. And that seems like the right place for the film to end. It's like a perfect little beat.
It's a great place for us to end. So we'll end it there. Matt, thanks for joining us and having this conversation. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, me too. Thank you so much, John, for having me. This was a lot of fun. I like this.